The blurb calls the poetry an astonishing confluence of music and meaning unprecedented in American poetry. And while the music is evident, just picking up the book and reading a line or two, or best, hearing it in the author's voice, the poetry's meaning is rich with allusions to the end of the American Empire, the notion of past lives lived on lost mythical continents, and a play-by-play account of what it might be like in the effort to become fully human. All done in the serial manner in which the narrative of the spirit is unveiled in the act of writing. The blurb is on the back of Nod House, the latest book from poet Nate Mackey, published by New Directions. A professor for many years at the University of California, Santa Cruz, he now teaches at Duke, and is also the author of books of fiction, criticism, and four other books of poetry, including the 2006 National Book Award-winning Splay Anthem. We talked to him today via Skype from North Carolina. Nate, welcome. You know, in our last interview, we discussed your serial poem, perhaps a world poem, in two threads that intertwine. Song of the Ondumbulu is a doggone funeral song directed to the spirit world about what you've called rough draft human beings. And the other part is Mu, which refers to several things we pointed out last time, Jane Harrison and Charles Olson's Muthos, which could be defined as irrational speech story with an affinity to the notion of mythos, as well as the mythic lost continent, some have called Lemuria, and the avant-garde jazz trumpeter Don Cherry's LP from the late 60s. What I want to know about is the notion of the serial poem itself. When did you first get a sense that you were doing a serial poem, or did you start this process with the notion that that was where you were headed?
I think I got the notion back in the 1970s. I was writing poems that were individual and more or less self-contained, but I was also reading a number of poets whose work was very resonant for me, and they were working in longer serial forms, and I was also listening to music that was getting into longer forms, and initial sense I had of things was that those two different things could go on in the same body of work, that you could have individual bounded poems, more or less self-contained, and you could have a series. And if you look at the first book I published, the chapbook, Four for Train, it's four poems that are not presented as though they are a part of a serial work, but they are related to one another. And then if you go on to the to Septet from the End of Time, which was a chapbook in 1983, again, there are eight poems, but they are related to one another. They all begin with the phrase, I wake up. And that had begun with there just being one of those poems, the first one, which is called Capricorn Rising. And I wrote it not thinking that I was writing a set of poems, but that I was writing a single poem. But I found that that phrase came back to me, and I wrote another poem beginning, I wake up, and yet another. And it turned out to be a set of eight poems. So even in Eroding Witness, which is the first full-length book collection in which those poems appear, there's a mix. The Song of the Ondumbulu, the first seven installments, and then there's it ends with Septet for the End of Time. So at that point, you know, I was missing it, but the possibility of serial work was still was still beginning to germinate, and it hadn't got to the point that it's gotten to lately where it's pretty much the defining feature of what I do. But you know, even at that early, the appeal of the serial form was making itself felt.
What is the appeal of the serial form? What attracts you to it?
The fact that you don't, the fact that things remain open. It's an open form. The aesthetic that, the well-wrought urn aesthetic, where a poem is this discrete, self-contained, accomplishment. everything fits together and works together in this well-oiled machine-like way. Imposes a certain sense of closure on each poem that I find constricting and found constricting. I wanted there to be the possibility of things coming into a poem that were not necessarily resolved in that poem, that were not necessarily pursued to their fullest or most exhaustive sense in the poem. I wanted things to come into the poem that, you know, that would have a life beyond that particular poem, and that would become a part of an exploration that I'd be involved in my writing. And so, the appeal of the serial poem is that it allows that. It's not so much a matter of, you know, it's there and it's done, but that, you know, again and again, again and again, again and again, you come back to certain concerns, certain motifs, certain figures. There's the freedom of not feeling that one has been definitive, you know, that one has closed things up, that one has shut the door on further exploration. And that's been a real driving force in a lot of the work that has been important to me, and it's become, you know, I think a feature of my work as well.
Yeah, it sounds like the notion of negative capability, rich with that. Which means on a couple of different levels, you are marginalizing yourself out of mainstream U.S. poetry, which likes that contained poem, something very neat that it can put on one page of an anthology and has a nice little compact meaning that we can use an objective correlative sense to figure out what it means and then kind of consume it and move on. It's really interesting that really it leads on to my next question, and that is the process of writing and being open to what the poem might propose is much about building a soul as it is about anything. And this book, Knot House, if you count the number of times you mention the word soul, we can, you know, I mean, this is, in a sense, it's really being hammered at us. You know, we wanted to find out what soul was. And so, I mean, I can just look at my notes and see so many different references to the notion of soul. Your own writing you describe as a search for soul. So there's a confluence there. Can you elaborate on, you know, I mean, even the notion of what it means to have a soul? Keats suggested that this planet was a veil of soul-making, and the notion that maybe we're not given a soul, but given the opportunity to build one. How does that notion inform what you're trying to do in Knot House?
Well, it's I mean, you've mentioned Keats twice now, and negative capability and the idea of soul-making, and those two things are related. The idea that you're, you know, you are born into a veil in which, you know, the soul is not given, but has to be made, or has to be found. And there are various ways in which, you know, Homo sapiens has gone about that. You know, one of them is poetry. The root of poetry, a poet means to make. A poet is a maker. And the notion that one has a hand in, you know, creating one's life is essential to that. And that creational impetus is, you know what has variously been called soul, you know, the inner life, sometimes spirit. You know, there are other words for it as well. So, you know, one of the things that comes up in Knot House is a kind of quizzical, sometimes inverse or even negative relationship to that project, because or that prospect, because often, you know, it's kind of a question. You know, it's usually proposed in the phrase "what soul was." I'm not sure how many instances, if there are any instances, where it should put out there as soul. So it's nobody wanted to know what soul was, or you know, so soul is there in that book as you know, as the object of a quest or a question that some are attending to and some are not. But certainly the suggestion is, and certainly the momentum that you get from the work is that it is attending to that. But as I said, it's psyche. It's in the deepest sense. I mean, or you know, it's meaning. It's what we mean by, you know, trying to find meaning in our lives. And language is, of course, you know, a central instrument of that. And poetry is, you know, is nothing if not, you know, the use of that instrument and the carrying of that instrument to certain lengths and hopefully heights, you know, in which the you know, the work of soul making is advanced. You know, it's again something that's not easy to talk about, and that's probably one of the reasons that I resort to poetry to talk about it. It's a vocabulary that is in that's out of fashion in a lot of quarters, even in poetry quarters, in which that vocabulary has traditionally been at home. So, you know, to find a way to continue to pursue that, but at a time where that term has almost been bracketed, it's one of the things that, you know, that I've been trying to do, and that Knot House is one of the latest installments in doing.
It's very interesting because, you know, we live in a time in history here in the United States in which a reductionist mentality is being taken to its obvious, well, perhaps not its obvious extremes, but to its extremes, certainly. And in this mentality, nothing exists unless you could see it or touch it or taste it or smell it or hold it in your hands. So soul doesn't exist. in this mentality, taken to the most logical extreme. And so this book is, in a way, is a reference to that. I mean, you have notions of the quagmires that we're stuck in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere around the world. Notion of necropolitan police. I mean, the notion that this empire is ending, or maybe even this way of viewing soul is ending. So the two kind of go hand in hand. There are many references to, for example, Katrina and other kinds of things that were happening while the book was being written. And I wonder, what effect do these wars and do our current state of politics in this country have? What effect do they have on one's soul or one's ability to make a soul? Can you speak to that?
Well, I mean, in some ways, they challenge the very notion of soul, because they seem to be, they seem to be so much the actions of human beings reduced to some kind of state of autonomy, or to use another vocabulary. Zombies. It just suggests a kind of an inability to, to make the lives we say we want to live. If this is a veil of soul making, and what does it say that we are making these various catastrophes. There's certainly a way in which soul knows low places, and soul has to deal with low places, and that's certainly something that has come up in my work, and has come up in a lot of stuff that I've read, and that there that I sometimes make reference to. One way to understand these various catastrophes that we, that we're faced with is that they are, purgatorial, that they are a part of a process of growing up, of a process of maturation. One of the reasons that the figure of the Andumbulu speaks to me is the, is that it provides that figure of something that's provisional, that's a rough draft, that's on its way to being, something that's more fulfilled and more fulfilling. And so the fact that the soul is posed again and again in the book as a what, as a question. As a something being reached for, or in a context in which it seems that it's not being reached for by by large numbers of people and by large numbers of institutions. The testing time that the soul goes through is essential to understanding how you can have both those things, how you can have quagmire and some hope of, getting beyond quagmire.
Yeah, it seems to me that we live in a time that in many ways, the odds are stacked against those who would attempt to use this time to build a soul. But on the other hand, the opportunity now is greater. I think what little... even the smallest bit of work dedicated to that effort is rewarded. There's a quote from Max Muller in the book, Introduction to the Science of Religion is the name of the book that the quote is from. And the quote suggests, mythology is inevitable. It is natural. It is an inherent necessity of language. It is, in fact, the dark shadow which language throws on thought, and which can never disappear till language becomes altogether commensurate with thought, which it never will. You include this quote in Knothaus. Can you elaborate on why that quote's so important to you?
Because I think that lag between thought and language is one of the things that it drives the serial poem. I mean, the poem can never catch up. And it's, you know, it's a condition that creates what that quote refers to as a shadow. And the work tries to, you know, find what light it can in that shadow. But even having found the light, there's that lag, which, you know, can't quite present that light or that illumination with the immediacy that it might otherwise have. So one of the things that appealed to me about that quote, and it's been a quote that's been in my mind for a long time. There was a little book by Ernst Cassirer called Language and Myth that I read it in years ago, I think, you know, like early 70s, something like that. And, you know, about the same time I was thinking about myth-making and, you know, there were poets, especially poets who were involved with projects like ethnopoetics, but also, you know, precursors to that, Robert Duncan, writing about the truth and life of myth, who, you know, who saw poetry and who saw writing as a kind of myth-making process, a kind of, I think Diane Mukofsky talked about creating a personal mythology, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons that quote comes in is, you know, the resonance of myth and mythology and the mythic in the writing I've been doing. You know, one of the things that the title Mu goes back to is, you know, the Greek word mythos, you know, which has to do with myth, and, you know, Charles Olson was very, you know, very into and very excited to explicate, you know, via Jane Harrison. So, you know, that, there's a recursive quality, in the work I've been doing, and, you know, that would be an instance of it, this passage from Max Mueller's book, you know, read back in the 70s, coming up, you know, 40 years later, you know, in a book, you know, published in 2011. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I find myself doing that, going back to stuff, recursion and revisitation, with variation are staples of the writing I do.
Hopefully when you do revisit it, your effort to build a soul has been somewhat successful, so you have a deeper understanding or you see it from a different light. And that's been my experience. And I think that's the experience I have with the work of someone like you, because I can go back and read stuff that I've read before and take a year or 5 years or 10 years and get more out of it because I'm at a different place. And I think the best art is like that. The other notion about that lag between thought and language, or perception and language, lends itself to a serial approach, because, you know, you can't quite get there. You're striving to do that. So each new part of the serial poem is like a stab to try and get closer to that. So perhaps that's part of why the serial poem is something that you find is the best way to try and close that gap or narrow it.
Or to make your peace with being in that gap, of being in that lag. I mean, lag is a word that comes up a number of times in, you know, in the poems. The phrase lag anthem occurs in Splay Anthem, and at various points in Song of Beyond Ndumbulu and in Mu, lag is spelled with a capital L, as though it were a place.
Mm-hmm.
And so to
When I look at page 62 and page 64, there's a similarity in the book. Page 64 almost seems like a second take. Was that, and you know, I know you're influenced by jazz, and there are many references to jazz and other kinds of world music in the book. I love the notion that it would be a second take. You know, it's like, I didn't quite get it. Let's try that again, you know? And you don't want to lose the spontaneity, you know, but... Can you speak to that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. That's not the first time that occurs. It happened in Splay Anthem towards the end, where a passage that appeared on one page appeared a couple pages later with some variation, and certainly. You know, the idea of first, second, third, fourth takes, apply. But again, it's back to what, you know, I said earlier, which is that, it gives a sense or it accepts a sense of provisionality, that what you see on page 62 was not final. Nor is what you see on page 64 final. I mean, these are two versions that are of something. You know, there's so much that's the same in them that you can see that they're versions of some same thing. And the idea that they could be very, maybe endlessly, I think is there. But it also should shed a certain light or a certain way of looking. On the rest of the work, the surrounding work, that isn't, repeated in as obvious a form as that. That work, too, is not definitive in some kind of final way, but it, too, can be, it, too, is subject to further takes. And in some ways, that's what serial, work is. Take after take after take. And it was... I had a certain resistance to actually making that quality that obvious, but I did it. I had done it in Display Anthem, and I did it again. I mean, I guess what one would typically do would be to take the second version as a revision of the first. And give it a certain authority and a certain finality, mm-hmm. simply get rid of the first and say, this is it. But I didn't necessarily feel that way about the second version. I mean, it was a version. I mean, it wasn't, it wasn't the it, that was being striven for, in some kind of ultimate way that would exclude all other possible versions. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I found that I did have a bit of resistance, within myself to doing that, but did do it. But kind of scary because one could probably do that with every page.
I'm thinking we get a look at how your mind works when we see something like that. It's like, how did he go, and what was similar, and what changed, and how did the music carry him here, and how did it not hit there? That's one notion that comes up. Another notion, of course, to jazz. I listen to. I give you one example of the perhaps thousands of examples. Now that they, these jazz guys die and they go through the vault and they find alternate versions, and we want to know more about them. So we'll take any material that comes out. Bill Evans and Jim Hall did a record called Undercurrents, and they did a couple of different versions of My Funny Valentine. And I like one so much better than the other. I don't know if it's the first take or the alternate take, but that's one example. And the last notion that comes up for me when you use the word provisional or provision, you know, I'm back on the golf course, and you know, you hit a drive and it's way the fuck out somewhere, and it's like, well, I better hit a provisional ball just in case I don't find that one, you know. So, you know, it's like, oh man, that might be way out there. Let me try reeling that one in and see if I don't slice or whatever. So these are some notions that come up as you talk about that.
But I was always, you know, talking about music again. I remember back in, you know, when I was in college, and I guess I started listening to music back in junior high school, and I remember having conversations with a good friend of mine who was really into the music as well, and we would talk about Coltrane, and something he said that stayed with me, I think applies to this, which was that, you know, though Train sounds like he's looking for some right note, that he's testing these various notes, a friend of mine said, well, no, that's not it. All of those notes are the right notes. He wants you to hear all of those notes. It's not that he's to mix the metaphor, like a batter, you know, fouling off pitches until he gets the right one. All of them are the right one, and he wants you to hear all of them. So, you know, there's a kind of post-scarcity aesthetic that kind of versioning.
Post what? Also skip some of the songs, such as 63 and 65 and 69. Are these outtakes that weren't up to snuff, or what's the reason for that?
No, those are actually, they're there, but they're there in the form of the loop horn. Starting with Splay Anthem, Song of the Antum
So how do we get a 66 and a half out of the deal?
just a bent note, a half step, you know. it was playing with something. In What's That Seraph, I got the song of the Andun Bulu 33, and I wrote a song of the Andun Bulu 33 and a half, which is, you know, playing with, you know, with something that's very much a part of the work, which is references to music, and especially to recorded music, throughout these travels and these movements. They're recurring references to something being on the box, as in a jukebox or a boom box, a piece of music. So this kind of phonographic thread that runs through the work was being played with this 33 and a half, which is just off of being 33 and a third, which back in that old technology of vinyl LPs, you know, was the speed at which you played it. So anyway, it was, but that itself was bent. I mean, it was, you know, I remember giving a reading and reading the poem and announcing it as just 33 and a half. And somebody in the audience said, "You mean 33 and a third?"
That's what I was going to say.
if you could actually take, you know, one of those LPs and play them at 33 and a half, the sound would be different.
You know, they did that with Miles. I understand with Kind of Blue, the original recording was just a little bit too slow. So when you played it, it came back just a little bit too fast, and they remastered it at the right speed. Did you know about that?
I didn't hear it about Kind of Blue. Maybe I did. I remember them talking. There was a radio project, the Miles Davis radio project, a while back, and I remember something of that coming up, but apparently it happened not just on Kind of Blue, but it happened on another one of his later recordings as well. Teo Macero was kind of a genius at doing that, manipulating tape speeds and doing the splicing and stuff like that. But anyway, it was this, you know, but it was this idea, well, what if it, you know, it's an allusion to 33 and a third. An allusion to that whole phonographic, you know, motif that runs throughout the work.
Yeah.
But bending it in the way that the sound would be bent by playing it at 33 and a half rather than 33 and a third. And then that opens up the whole business of, you know, of bent notes and blue notes, you know, that, you know, it's part of the whole, you know, African diaspora musical tradition. So anyway, so one of the things, one of the things that I decided to do was, well, I'll revisit that, you know, every 33 songs. So there's a 60, the 66 then has a 66 and a half. And, in fact, the book that will follow, Nod House, has a 99 and a half. So it just became a kind of, form or convention, you know, within the larger work that I instituted. You know, I made it an executive decision that would be the case.
I understand. The book tracks the effort to become more fully human, and it feels very phenomenological. And so there's a couple things I wonder about this. So this, I guess, is a two-part question, and I'm not sure exactly how to ask it, but I'm wondering how the process of writing the poetry aligns with your own way of writing fiction. Is there a sketch or outline from which you write individual poems? And how do you make it so visceral when, you know, could you have been there? I'm not sure. You know, they're in the process of purgatory. They're in the process of, the Buddhists might look at it as the place where you are before you drink that bowl of soup and forget all about your past life and incarnate again. So, a couple of different angles to that question. Do you use a sketch?
I'm not sure I know what you mean by sketch. If you mean outline,
yeah.
No.
No. No, that's what I mean. An outline of, you know, this chapter is going to do this, and this chapter is going to do that, and what have you.
I don't find an outline. I mean, I don't start with an outline in most cases. I find something, shape, outline, sketch, in the course of the writing, possibilities of form and structure as I write. The way I write poetry and the way I write fiction are pretty much the same. The one grew out of the other. The Dear Angel of Dust series, the first few letters, and what became that series actually occur in the song of Beyond Dumbulu. But again, back to what I said earlier about coming into writing, writing a piece, writing pieces, with some sense of what's on one's mind, some sense of what one wants to get down on paper, some sense of what one wants to say. There's that, but there's also leaving oneself open to what is in that you wouldn't necessarily know at the beginning is in there. And these are just writing is an activity, and certain things happen in the course of writing that, you don't plan. Certain directions, and that's, you have to do it. You have to put yourself in, in the act of writing for those things to happen. You can't plan it all out, in advance. Mm-hmm. So I try, to have, some kind of grip on, the things that are a moment, for my writing, but not too tight a grip. And to let the writing, in a sense, talk back to me. A lot of what I do is, just jotting things down that are fragments or pieces that I don't know, how they're going to fit with other pieces. But I just, negative capability. I don't require that I understand that yet. I work towards understanding it. I work towards, seeing, what is this the tip of? What is this a piece of? Not that I necessarily get to some kind of symmetrical, coherent piece of writing that offers all of those sort of classical rational amenities.
Right.
But I do get to something that seems to have some. Well, to me, I mean, the test is that is there life in it? I mean,
and does it swing?
Does it swing? That's enough. That's what people are talking about when they say when they talk about swing. Is it animate?
Mm-hmm.
Is it animate?
Uh-huh.
I think I. Years ago, I read this book by this book called A Musical View of the Universe, and I make reference to it in a number of places in my critical work and elsewhere. And it's about people, and I think the Kalapulo in South America and their notions of the world and of life, and music plays a large part in how they see the universe, and they look at things in the world as occupying different orders of animacy, and as it turns out for them, music is has the highest order of animacy, but for me, swing is another way of talking about an order of animacy, and we can see that not just in music, but does a painting, you know, what order of animacy does this painting have? What order of animacy does this this story or this poem have? What order of animacy does this piece of sculpture, arise at? So that, you know, that's kind of, you know, I feel my way, and that's what I'm feeling and groping and looking for, you know, something that has that, something that is animate, mm-hmm. and swings.
So the process is very organic, as you describe it, and Denise Levertov had a sort of a friendly amendment to what Robert Creeley told Charles Olson, and that is, form is never more than a revelation of content. And it seems that that's exactly what you're talking about, the process of discovery. It seems to me that when reading poetry that has that process of discovery, it's more satisfying to me than that poetry which doesn't, and we alluded to this earlier. But getting back to the other part of the question, how phenomenological this work reads in something that I guess we've experienced, we have to, if this is the process of what happens to us before we, you know, incarnate as human beings. So, I guess I'm a little dumbstruck by how this work, that in a sense is fiction, has such a feeling of being there. Maybe that's just the quality of the work, Nate. I don't know.
Elsewhere, or comes from elsewhere, or mm-hmm. comes from inside. You mm-hmm. know, again, the sense of an inner life, mm-hmm. you know, soul making, spirit, you know, the spirit within the letter. You know, I think there's a strong, I know there's a strong drive in me to, you know, to be, you know, to be a carrier of that sense in the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to whatever extent, you know, that I do, you know, I'm, you know, mission accomplished, I guess.
I think so. You know, Knot House is the title of the book, and at one moment in the book, the narrator looked out the Knot House, looked into each face, and then in italics, we'd see what face was only front for. And then later on that page, soul is described as a certain bareness. And, you know, I get this notion, and perhaps one interpretation, is the Knot House is that place in purgatory where you're waiting for that Knot to incarnate again. And once you get the Knot, you're a human again, and you forget about all that happened on one sense. In another sense, you have some kind of access to it that's maybe not that articulate. I want to go to, I would like to, there's just two more notions I want to get to this time. And, you know, I think about the notion of Mu, that lost continent. You know, you read the Wikipedia definition, and of course it never existed. It's just mythic. You know, with Wikipedia and the materialist mindset, which we're still dealing with, you know, you have to take those kinds of things with a grain of salt. You have to be a conscious, you know, in the wake of the information age, you have to be a real conscious person. You really have to be media literate. And I myself believe that we've had these previous worlds. Maybe it was pre-pole shift. Maybe the pole shift was the planet's effort to get rid of us humans for a while so that it could heal. And maybe we're getting close to that point again. And, you know, human history is filled with examples of endless violent occupations. The rich squeezing out every last penny out of the poor. But environmental degradation that affects planetary climate systems, genetically modified food foisted on an unknowing public, nuclear radiation deadening large swaths of the sea, and other man-made catastrophes are really getting quite intense here as we lunge for the Mayan finish line in December. So can you talk to about, you know, how that Mu and Lemuria and the previous civilizations inspire you or inform this work?
Well, yeah, I mean, all the stuff that you're talking about, you know, we live in apocalyptic times, and you know, maybe all times are apocalyptic. Certainly, you know, we have testimony from, you know, down through the ages of, you know, people who, you know, have felt that they were in apocalyptic times and pointed to the various forms of evidence that they had, you know, in the ages that they lived in. Mu and you know, its cousins, Atlantis, Lemuria, I mean, they're omens, they're warnings. They're warnings of, as are the Undumbulu. The Undumbulu are a failed form of human being that did not survive, that were, you know, and now survive in this stunted form underground in Dogon cosmology. Over the years, it's kind of struck me and kind of been a haunting fact for me that these two serial poems that you know that have taken over my work have to do with this rather ominous material. You know, the song of the Undumbulu, a funeral song, the Mu, you know, resonant with lost continents, sunken continents, you know, that could be a picture of the future. It's certainly, you know, certainly a believable picture of the future, and maybe it is cyclical, and maybe, you know, these things are the baths of rebirth that will, you know, that have to be undergone before new continents, new formations can arise. But the but that's a that sense of an age coming to an end, that sense of trial and tribulation, necessary trial and tribulation, on these various fronts that you talk about. I mean, the ongoing endless war, that's plural and it's kind of stationed geographically and temporally, and the degradation of the planet and the atmosphere, the wiping out of species, the momentum towards wiping out ourselves, all these things inflect the work, but there was something about there was something that seemed appropriate about those two titles, about those two works. I mean, there was something I heard in that Dogon song, and there was something I heard in that music, and there was something that the whole proposition of continents being lost, and perhaps re-arising in other forms, that still stays with me, and Nothaus is certainly a further articulation of that.
Maybe the next cataclysmic flood will take out all the red states. all right, that's just kind of a joke. The last.
And remember that Nod is that land that Abel, that desert that Abel wanders in. After killing Abel, that Cain wanders in after killing Abel. That was a kind of overtone that I heard in that title as well.
Uh-huh. Many would suggest that what the Mayans were after was not the end of time, but an end to one way of seeing time and a yet-to-be world available to us. Do you have a sense that we are at a historical time where that kind of world is possible, that this is the dark before the dawn, an age that has more justice, real freedom, and sustainability to it? I mean, I read lines like on page 40 in the poem Blue Annuncia's Bird Lute, where the line goes, "Yet to be world on the tips of their tongues."
Yeah, well, the purgatorial or provisional quality of the work is aimed at some sense that that something new can come of crisis. That something new and necessary. That the crisis itself is a revelation of the limitations of a particular mindset, a particular way of seeing and doing things. Crisis is an occasion for critical reevaluation and the finding of new ways. And the sense that you put forth, I think, is very much the sense that informs the possibility of hope. And I don't think I would be writing if I didn't think there was that possibility. I don't know quite what I would be doing.
You'd be living in a bunker. You'd be getting cans of baked beans in your bunker.
And there are people doing that.
And they live in Idaho. as a matter of fact, I heard a thing on NPR where a real estate guy specializes in survivalists.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's sort of like, it's all going to blow, and I want to be one of the people who survive it. If it's all going to blow, I just think I'm more interested in a more collective survival or revival than that. I'm not so interested in, making sure that, increasing my chances of individual survival. So, and that's, I think that's what the crisis has to bring us to, some way in which, we can all, or at least, most of us, or future generations, can come through, and not just sit up on some
From your lips to God's ear, Nate Mackey.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Well,
there's a piece in the forthcoming issue of Hambone by Nathaniel Tarn that touches on this whole business of poetry and hope, and you know, especially in dark apocalyptic terminalist times. I was excited to see the lecture that he gave at the University of Chicago a couple months or so ago now. Anyway, it'll be in Hambone number 20, which is coming out in a few weeks.
That sounds like an edition one should buy 5 copies of and give away as gifts.
I think so.
Well, just a delight to get into this depth with your work. It's, you know, it's really an honor and a privilege, and I'm delighted to have it. So thanks very much, Nate.
Well, thank you for inviting me to have this conversation. I always like talking to you since we met, what's it been, a year or so ago now?
A little over a year, yeah. It was March of 11.
Yeah.